Patrick.
Shh, shh, shh.
I've got. Why are you shushing me? I'm trying to be businesslike. Oh. I always feel like I'm not businesslike.
Okay, do you need to be businesslike?
I don't know. It feels like I need to get stuff done in here. Get this done quickly. We always take too long.
All right.
I've got a question anyway.
All right.
Forgot why I was here for a second then. Do you like women? Okay, sorry. Do you respect women?
If yeah, they're all right, aren't they? I mean, it depends on.
They're
who
all
it is.
Right, aren't they?
It just depends on who it is. You can't ask a question. Do you respect women? It's like, do you think
it's all, better than do you like women?
Do you think all Italian people are brilliant? You know, it's like
I do
it's,
actually.
It's about
yeah.
as daft as that, isn't it? As a question goes, do you like women?
The Match, because 90 minutes can last a lifetime. Episode 3. 21st of April 2007, Fulham against Blackburn Rovers at Craven Cottage.
In the build-up to what looked like a pretty routine Premier League game in April 2007, a storm started to whirl around a football commentator. The Match of the Day rota had been sent out a few weeks earlier, the story was leaked, and the world seemed to go mad. Jackie Oatley would be commentating on Fulham against Blackburn and would make history as the first female commentator on the country's most iconic football show. And once I saw a Daily Mail article which said, "From Motti to Totti, as girl power conquers Match of the Day," it felt as if things had got out of control. The Mail had called Dave Bassett for a quote, and boy did he oblige. I'll read this neutrally rather than do an impression. He said, "Maybe the BBC are trying to be innovative and groundbreaking, but I think it undermines the credibility of the programme, and when she commentates at the weekend, I will not be watching." I don't know about you, but it's the "I will not be watching" that sticks in the throat. Anyway, he was entitled to his opinion, and that's what he said, and whether or not he echoed the feelings of the nation, the stage was now set for Jackie to make her step into the big time. She wasn't in the tunnel, well, not yet anyway, but this is how she was feeling before the game.
Well, I can honestly say it was the most surreal day of my entire life. So getting out of the car was a usual thing at Craven Cottage. I was a regular there. But this time it did feel very different, bearing in mind that I hadn't slept for 3 nights. I hadn't eaten for 3 days. My stomach was in a knot. And so nothing really fazes me too much, but this felt very different. And I was walking down the road towards the ground, very conscious of the fact that some people were looking at me, and that's never been an issue before. And I hadn't actually really been out for a few days since this all became a story on the Tuesday, and now of course it was a Saturday, so it was the first time I'd actually seen people since my face had been plastered all over the front page. And of course I was at the football match, so those people were going to know about the story. So surreal is the simplest way of summing it up, shall we say.
And it sort of got more surreal. I always remember you telling me about going up to the gantry, and a perfectly normal thing that we've all done a million times before and since, but there were photographers there, weren't there? And there was quite a noise around the gantry, I seem to remember you telling me.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a football match like any other for me. The normal scenario is walk from the car into the press box, chat with people. That's probably one of the best bits, is the social side of it in the press box before the game. But this time I had the director of communications come into the press room and bring another director with her, saying that he wanted to meet me. And this was all very unusual because it's obviously not about me. I'm a journalist. I'm there to tell the story about other people. So, of course, becoming the story made me feel very uncomfortable. But, of course, I was polite and chatted to the man, and then chatted to a colleague of mine who was just shaking his head going, "What on earth is going on?" This is Nigel Adderley, who was there for radio. And I was just saying, "Nigel, this is just nuts. I've just had the craziest week of my life." And he just couldn't believe what had happened. And I was told that somebody wanted to see me in the tunnel. So I always went to the tunnel anyway. I mean, bear in mind, this was my first match of the day. So I'd never done television before. It's a different process. You don't just go into the press room, get your notes, set up your radio equipment and carry on. I'd go into the trucks before that to see it. And I didn't really know what anybody did in the trucks. I'd never been in the trucks before. And I thought, where do I write my intro? My piece that you read out as the players come out. Obviously, I didn't know the team news at this point. So I didn't really say very much to anybody. I was just wide-eyed and taking it all in, and talked to the director. And I didn't really know who was going to be with me on the gantry, who was going to be in the trucks, who was going to be talking my ear, if anybody. It was all so new. And to have that kind of focus on me at the time, I'm not complaining about, but it just felt like my brain was like a tumble dryer with everything going round and round in it. I was trying to process the most important bit so that I could actually do my job. And all the way through that pre-match, I was just thinking, I just need to do my job. And all that week, all I'd been thinking was, I really just need to be able to do some prep. And I hadn't had time to do any prep that week because my phone hadn't stopped. So ahead of the most important match of my life, I hadn't done any prep until late the night before, when of course I should have been in bed because I hadn't slept all week. So it really was a crazy scenario, and I just thought, oh, just make the best of it and try and do the best commentary that you can. And so then I went to get the team news in the tunnel, and again it was a different scenario. Instead of asking for the team news and being given it and doing my formations and what have you, I was presented with a Fulham shirt by the Fulham manager, Laurie Sanchez. And I thought, okay, this is odd. And I had the club photographer there. And I just smiled and was thinking, right, let me sort of get my head around the team news and the changes from the last game and what have you. Then I got the Blackburn team news. They'd already given me a shirt via the Match of the Day office that week. So I got the two shirts and the two sides, which was very kind of them. And then I did the walk down the side of the pitch, and people were asking for my autograph and saying, good luck today, Jackie. Surreal again, very uncomfortable with this. Bear in mind, I'm not somebody that was after publicity at all. I had no interest in doing television when I changed career. I was only interested in the radio side of broadcasting, even though my postgrad was in radio and TV. So this wasn't anything that I was after at all. And the floor manager, Nick, said to me, well, normally we go down the front of the pitch, but you'll see there are a lot of photographers down there. And I looked across and thought, oh my goodness, why are they all facing me instead of the players? And why are they all in a line by the dugouts? This was really weird. He said, don't worry, we'll go round the back. So we went round the back of the stand and then started climbing up the ladder. it wasn't the most natural ladylike thing to be doing, was climbing a ladder with all these backpacks and rucksacks and a clipboard and notes of team news and stuff. And obviously these cameras, the lenses pointed at me, and I thought, oh God, this is going to come out great, isn't it? And then got up there onto the gantry, and as well as the two screens and the microphone and all the equipment that was already there, there was a photographer. And I was told that this was just one representative of all the photographers. So instead of having lots up there with me, I just had one. And I say just, but kept having these photographs taken and being asked to pose in all these directions. And I looked at my watch and it was 10 minutes till kickoff. And I had to say to the chap, and of course, with experience, I would have said, well, okay, let's have a couple and please, I've got to do my job. But because I was trying to be amenable to everybody and trying to do the right thing by everybody, I went along with what he was asking, and photographs posing over the pitch and looking that way and doing my notes. I was trying to just go about my normal business, but I was very conscious that there was a photographer snapping away. And eventually at 10:02, he left. And I thought, right, that doesn't really leave a great deal of time to actually prepare. So then I got my microphone. I think I'd written my intro by this point. And I just peered over the edge of the gantry and looked down. And I suddenly heard this noise of all these shutters of these cameras snap, 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 snapping away furiously, because obviously they'd been told to go, that was the story that day, bearing in mind it'd been building up all week in the newspapers. And I looked down and I looked back up and I thought, oh my goodness, that's just weird. That's very, very strange. And okay, I'm just going to get on with it. And then the players were all on the pitch, and then the referee was Graham Pole, and I looked at him, and then he looked at me and he gave me the thumbs up and said, good luck. And I thought, can this day get any more bizarre when the Premier League referee is looking up at the gantry and wishing me luck in my commentary of Fulham Blackburn? It was just so odd. So I think the biggest relief came when the whistle blew and suddenly nobody was looking at me anymore. And it was, oh, it was relief. And then of course came the, okay, I better talk now. How much do I talk? How much do I talk? I'd never done this before. I'd not even done a trial run. I'd not even had time at home to practice, to think about it, to watch Match of the Day until drying my hair that morning. And I remember turning the TV on in my room really, really loudly with a Steve Wilson commentary from the previous week on Sky Plus, trying to listen to the pace and tone of his commentary, because I'd just been on the phone all that week to very kind people wishing me well, though the ones that weren't asking for interviews. And that day it was just a case of getting through it and hopefully surviving unscathed. And fortunately, I got through it and I did several more commentaries in Match of the Day. And the next one at Anfield was like a walk in the park in comparison. It was just straightforward and nobody cared anymore, which was how it would have been lovely in the first place. But hey, that's life.
The interesting thing about hearing all of that, I was one of the people, of course, talking to you that week, wasn't I? And I had no idea how hard it must have been to do your job and to focus and to do all of those things. And when you hear all of that, you realise how remarkably well you did to get through 90 minutes, because particularly those 2 hours before a game, regardless of the prep you've done in the week, are absolutely crucial. And in a way, that was the unfair thing, wasn't it? That, you know, you were being set up to do a commentary, you were in the public eye, and you weren't even being given a fair chance, if you like, to do it.
In an ideal world, I would have had that week to do my prep, the time that I'd allocated. I had other shifts that week. I was still doing radio stuff. And I'd allocated some time, and that time just disappeared. And I take my prep really serious. I was always getting told off by my Five Live boss for doing too much prep. But the way I saw it is, fill my head with information and therefore you can just pick out the bits you need whenever you need them. But that week was just completely different because I didn't have time. And I remember phoning Mark Crossley the night before, who was Fulham coach at the time, and saying, "Have the team, please, any nuggets?" I was saying, this is a little bit nuts. And he was great because I'd commentated with him before and he was a really nice lad. But instead of doing my normal prep and, of course, plenty more and thinking how I was going to do things and ideas for intros and stuff, all that was out the window. And I just did the most basic prep very late the night before. And so, yes, that was the biggest thing for me, because I knew that if I could do a decent job on a Saturday, then nothing else mattered. But trying to maintain that focus of getting my information that I needed and filling my head with the right information and visualising how it's all going to work and doing my prep on sort of the pace and rhythm of TV commentary, which of course is so different. And I'm not sure people who haven't commentated perhaps have thought about that. And why would they? It's so different to doing a full 90 minutes live and having a summariser with you, a former player who you have banter with, and you know, you're joking about this and that, and you're asking them questions and you're describing what you see, you're painting pictures for the listeners, and then you're throwing over to a race meeting at Ayr, and then you're throwing over to a live match at Brentford, an update from wherever else. So it's completely different. It was just me, it was the full commentary. I didn't know at the time that it was probably going live around the world. I had no idea until after the match. All these things that I just didn't know about until afterwards. So again, I'm not going to complain about that, because it was the way it was, and I don't think anybody anticipated the sort of interest there would be. Certainly I didn't, perhaps naively. I thought that, okay, there might be some interest, but I was hoping that would be after the match. And certainly not on the Tuesday morning, when unfortunately it found its way into a national newspaper. And of course, then the Wednesday, it became a big full page spread of should she be allowed to do it, shouldn't she, with voices pro and con. And of course, the cons were the ones that then made the story, because people saying, Dave Bassett saying, everyone in football's against it, which was news to me because nobody in football knew I was doing it yet. So I wasn't sure how they knew that they were against it. And of course, that sparked the sexism storm. So the front page of the Daily Telegraph with a giant photo, and the front page of The Guardian saying, is football ready for Jackie Oatley? For me, looking at this stuff, I just couldn't get my head around it, because I wasn't doing anything different to anybody else. I was just a female. That was all. I wasn't doing anything differently. I hadn't taken a different route particularly than anybody else. I started in hospital radio and then local radio, did a postgrad for a year. I worked my way up right from the very, very bottom. Doing commentary in non-league football to start with, and then radio, local radio, and national radio. And I'd been doing Premier League commentaries every week, but of course for radio. And it was really that day and that week in total that really brought it home to me, the difference between radio and television in terms of exposure. I was pretty naive to that at that time, because as far as I was concerned, I was just a journalist telling a story, whether I tell it on the radio or tell it on the TV. Shouldn't have been that big a deal. But of course, once it had become a sexism issue and that became the story, and there were phone-in debates on radio, on TV, and I think I woke up on the Wednesday morning, as I always did, to Five Live, my radio clock, and Five Live News at 7 o'clock. And in the, you know, the little sequence at the top of the hour, they always have the stories. And my name was in that sequence. And bear in mind, this is the station that I work for. I was coming round thinking, what on earth is going on? What's happening here? How have I become a story 3 days before? a football match, an 8.5 minute edit at 12:45 between Fulham and Blackburn. How is that such a big story? I couldn't understand it. I didn't see myself as different to anybody else in any way, apart from the obvious, I suppose. But so that really took me back. And then the fact that my phone didn't stop and my emails, I used to have a Yahoo Messenger thing in those days, which used to ping up with emails. And I just remember hearing this whoosh about, I was probably averaging one email a minute about this. And so many of them were interview requests. And stupidly, and this is my biggest regret now, stupidly, I replied to every blooming interview request, bearing in mind there were countless. And of course, I knew lots of people from local radio, having worked in it for years. And so I knew lots of people who had my number, so they were phoning, asking for favours. I've been asking. And I emailed every single person. I remember a commercial station I'd never heard of in Wales. And I wrote them a whole long email about the reasons that I was politely declining their interview request. And of course, I should have just forgotten all of that and waited till the Monday morning. And then if I wanted to reply, I replied to them all saying, really sorry, I hope you understand, last week was a bit crazy. Apologies. But stupidly, I spent all my time being polite and trying to do the right thing, replying to everybody and spending all the time answering every phone call and picking up voicemails. And it was people being really kind, people such as you, Dave, who were kind of going, I can't quite believe what's going on, but right, anyway, about Saturday, about TV commentary. And
I can remember, actually, I was felt that I was trying to focus you on the job and sort of say, you do realise, let's talk through what you've got to do. And I know you spoke to a couple of other commenters, I think, trying to sort of realise what you had to do on the day and stuff, but it was madness around you, wasn't it? I mean, I can remember thinking how surreal it was when I saw your name in the paper, thinking, that's my mate. Let alone what it must have been like for you. And it sounds like you were a bit distanced from it in that way, almost like that's not me when you're looking at the name in the paper, because it's all happened so quickly.
It was really odd because I was single at the time. I was living in a one-bedroom flat and so I didn't see anybody for days. I remember a friend of mine came over, I think it was about a Friday, with a bag of shopping from Sainsbury's because I didn't have any food in the flat. I don't know why I didn't go anywhere.
Was it because you didn't want to go out and there were paparazzi outside the door or something, or that kind of feeling?
No, I only had one call from that regard. And I remember buzzing down on my intercom and saying, thank you very much, but I'm not willing to chat about this. So I turned down every interview, obviously, because I didn't want to be the story. I didn't want to add any fuel to the fire. Whether that was the right thing to do or not, I don't know, because then people got the wrong end of the stick about my background. They didn't have a clue. There wasn't anything about me on the internet. There was no Twitter at the time. So people didn't know my lifelong obsession with football and that I'd played the game and injured my knee and changed career. They didn't know any of that. They just assumed I was just some random bird that they thought, right, let's get a woman to do Match of the Day, she'll do. So it was just really odd that I hadn't been out for a few days. I think because my phone didn't stop and my emails didn't stop and I was too busy replying to everybody. But yeah, I just remember sitting on my sofa and speaking to Steve Wilson, speaking to you, speaking to my boss at the BBC, who was saying, okay, we're going to take you off that Five Live shift on Thursday night to give you a bit of breathing space. I was like, okay, thanks for that. trying to get advice from people. Motti left me a voicemail. That was kind of him. Mike Ingham, chief football correspondent of Five Live, sent me a lovely email, really supportive. And that actually meant a huge amount, saying you fully deserve to be doing this and good luck with it. And just a little thing like that meant so much. People were really supportive. Colleagues who knew me were really supportive. And I think they were thinking, oh, I really wouldn't have fancied that for my first match of the day. And I remember the next match of the day that I did at Anfield, seeing Alistair Bruce Ball in the press room. And I hadn't seen him since the previous one. And he said, you know, the weirdest thing about all that coverage was people saying, well, what would she know? She's never kicked a ball. And he said, well, you played football? He said, I've never played. And no one's ever asked me whether I have. And that was just one little snippet as to the craziness of it all, the assumptions that were being made about me, the phone calls that have been put in, the long lost friends reunited at that time before Facebook really came along, and long lost people saying, oh, just to let you know, I've had so-and-so newspaper asking about what you were like at school, and do I have any photos of you playing football at school, and a friend of mine saying that a newspaper journalist was trying to get some dirt on you, and were you a lesbian? And this person then went on to become my boyfriend, by the way. And I just thought, well, why would you try and paint anything like that as a negative anyway? It was just really eye-opening. And of course, as a journalist, I understand what makes a story. I understand what people want to find. And I remember being on the phone to my mum and ding-dong, the bell went. It was the News of the World wanting photos of me playing football in the garden. It was just very unusual, and we put it down to experience. And oh my goodness, what a fantastic experience with hindsight. That whilst I would never have wanted that to happen, ideally, I'd love to have just done it like anybody else. Of course, it happened. I survived it. I'm way, way, way stronger as a character now. And I use that experience to try to help other women. That's really important to me. Really, really important, which is why I'm a director of Women in Football. It's a very much a voluntary role and takes up quite a lot of time. But it's really important to me to support, sounds a bit patronising, but to encourage the next generation of women who maybe think, I don't know, is it going to be stressful being a commentator? Or do I really want to put myself in the firing line, be at the coal face and risk asking angry managers questions moments after they've come off the pitch and they could put me away and whatever? And I'm very, very strong on absolutely you have to do that and you have to back yourself, because I think women generally, this is a generalisation, I think a lot of women maybe struggle with confidence, bearing in mind that they're often the only one in the press box or the only one in their office. And I think it's really, really important that now there are a few more of us to try to help those women, encourage them and say, you've got to back yourself. Don't wait for somebody else to invite you to commentate. I didn't wait to be invited to commentate on local radio. I told my sports editor boss that I would like to do it. I couldn't think of a good reason why I shouldn't, just because the other women weren't doing it and the men all went on to commentate, so why wouldn't I at least give it a go? And I was fortunate that they said okay and crazily gave me a go, and it all went from there. But I think you have to back yourself and you have to back other women as well to make sure that that they can give themselves the confidence to do it.
I don't know which angry manager you could possibly be referring to, by the way. We probably won't go there, but one of the extraordinary things, before we talk about, if you like, the aftermath of all of this, the gradual aftermath of all of this, is to make it absolutely clear about you. I can remember at the time friends of mine making similar comments to the ones that you've said about what's she doing on Match of the Day and so on, and me saying, you all think I'm a football geek. If we sat here now and you did a football trivia quiz, as long as it wasn't about Serie A from the 1980s, if it was a normal football trivia quiz, she would beat me. And I meant that then, I meant it all along, and I still mean it today. And I think at the time, no one bothered to know that, did they? And that was one of the great ironies for me. And for you mentioned Nigel Adderley. I remember us talking about it, saying, God, I mean, Nigel probably beats us both, to be fair. But yeah. But, you know, but I can remember saying that the mad thing about this is they're treating Jackie like she's some, you know, woman who's just turned up off the street almost, and they're giving a go, whereas we both know how passionate she is. And actually, all you ever wanted to be, I remember you always used to say this to me, I just want to be a commentator. I don't care about how I look. I don't care about, you know, the image and so on and so forth. I just want to be, if you like, a good commentator, a jobbing commentator. That's what you always wanted to be. And that, for me, was the great irony of that week.
It was, and that's why there was such a dichotomy between the perceptions of me and people who knew me, because I think, as I mentioned, there wasn't anything really on the internet particularly about me. Why would there be? A couple of articles maybe. But the people that know me growing up and my school friends and what have you would know that it was an all-encompassing obsession with football. I'd always loved sport right from as long as I can remember. I'd loved sport, always watched the World Snooker Championship, Wimbledon, wall-to-wall, Olympics, wall-to-wall, anything that was on. Remember, there wasn't as much those days. And then when I accidentally stumbled across a football match one day, having had no introduction to it, and something clicked in my head, and I thought, this is a sport for me. From that day onwards, it was an all-consuming obsession, and my friends at my all-girls school thought I'd completely lost the plot and had no idea what on earth had got into me, and thought it must be because I was trying to pull boys or impress boys. And of course, they soon realised that wasn't the case when I was going to Grimsby on a Tuesday night on the supporters coach. That was the case. But the thing that got me was, why would you want to be a football commentator if you weren't completely and utterly obsessed with football? Why would you even if, say, somebody had said, hey, love, do you fancy being a football commentator? Why would you say yes, please, if you weren't completely consumed by it? Because it would be completely insane. You'd be caught out at the first hurdle. You wouldn't get anywhere. So, and also, there are so many hundreds of thousands of lads in the country who would die to do that. So why would you be put there instead of them if you weren't the real deal in terms of at least wanting to do it and being incredibly passionate about it? So there were quite a few comments that I'd heard during that week which really made me laugh. And because there were all these phone-ins and stuff, and I didn't listen to anything, but I was having my friends text me and phone me and say, I've just heard this debate, and there was one on Breakfast and BBC Breakfast, and there was one on radio. Should she be allowed to do it? Shouldn't she? People were phoning up with their opinions. I find very amusing.
Just go back to 2007, Jack.
Yeah.
Should she be allowed to do it is an extraordinary question, isn't it? But I thought that was one of the, again, one of the interesting things about the period, that we could have a whole different political conversation about this, but it sort of did a lot of good in the sense it brought a lot of this to the fore, because how are we having that conversation? Should she be allowed to do it in 2007? I mean, it really is something when you take a step back, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It was bizarre at the time. It's bizarre now to think it was 10 years ago that those questions were happening. I mean, fortunately, a lot of the newspaper coverage was actually a lot of columnists putting that point, saying, what is going on? So it's not as if the coverage was all bad, but it was, I think there were a lot of football fans who were saying things such as, how could she possibly commentate when she hasn't got the passion for it? What are you talking about? What are you? You have no idea about my history of having a season ticket, standing on the South Bank terrace and getting there an hour early to soak up the atmosphere and travelling home and away to every game and not really studying for my GCSEs and A-levels because they coincided with major tournaments and I couldn't face not watching, changing career because I couldn't bear to actually be in an office and not watch every single minute of a major tournament, because it hadn't occurred to me when I got a proper job that people didn't actually get time off to watch major football tournaments. And then I realised I had to buy a Casio television to take out at meetings with me because I just couldn't bear to miss it. And yet nobody knew any of this stuff. And of course, turning down all the interviews meant that people didn't get to know that. But that wasn't my problem in a way. I didn't really care what people thought about me. I just wanted to do the job properly. That was it. And then even afterwards, I was invited to go on various celebrity shows and was offered a lot of money to go on these things. And I turned them all down.
Were you offered Big Brother? Celebrity Big Brother? No. The Jungle? Were you offered The Jungle?
No.
There's still time, Jack.
No, there was a couple of reality shows. And I was just thinking, no, because I didn't want to be, certainly didn't want to be a novelty for crying in a bucket, but I didn't want to be a celebrity. I mean, it would have been so much easier to take that money and buy some nice clothes and get my hair done and whatever. And start going down that TV route and personality route. But why on earth would I want to do that? I was a geek who went to non-league football on my night off to build contacts, to learn how to become a journalist. And so why would I suddenly give all that up for some world that was nothing I had any aspiration to be part of? So no, I just tried to do the right thing. I wanted to be a journalist, stay being a journalist, try not to be the story. Came through all that, and I've carried on being a journalist since. And thank goodness for that, because that's all I've ever wanted to be, is just like anybody else, but doing the job to the best of my ability.
In retrospect, it could have been handled better, couldn't it, by those who were employing you, in retrospect? Without picking anyone out individually, because I think everyone, you already said that you were naive, you said, about what the reaction would be. I think a lot of us were, going back to the conversation I had with Nigel, that conversation was before the Tuesday when it all broke. And I don't think either of us were saying, my God, you know, it's got to be newspaper stories. I think everyone was blindsided by it. But when there are PR departments and when there are things like that, you should have been protected probably a little bit more, shouldn't you? We perhaps should have seen this coming a bit more.
Yeah, well, maybe. I mean, I don't know. I think people at work tried to treat me the same as anybody else, in the sense that they put my name down on the rotor originally for Watford, Manchester City, and then that wasn't going to be a BBC OB, so they changed it to Fulham, Blackburn. But they just put my name down on the rotor and circulated in the same way they would anybody else. So I think they tried to treat me the same way as everybody else, which I respected. What were they supposed to do? Put down commentator TBC? Maybe. I don't know. I don't really worry about that. It's out of my control, so I don't worry about that. I don't blame anybody for the way they handled anything from the BBC side of things. They tried to stand up for me once it had broken. I remember Niall Sloan doing an article in the paper, something along the lines of Harry Enfield sketch, woman, know your limits, and he did it based on that, and about how some people thought that I should have known my limits. And it was all very, people were just incredulous as to what had happened. So it wasn't leaked intentionally. It came out in the, I don't think it was even vindictively, personally. I think it was more of a point of interest that information gets shared about all sorts of things. And of course, it was in the newspaper in a little column piece, just a few lines. But of course, that gets read and then picked up the next day once it's been put to other people. But I don't blame anybody for that. I really don't have any kind of issues. The only issue I do have, that I have to be honest about, that I really struggled with, was when there were things that were written that were completely false. I really struggled with that. And I had no means of comeback. There was no Twitter at the time for me to go, hang on, this isn't actually true. So the problem I had was on the Monday morning, I got various papers delivered anyway. And I picked up the back page of one national newspaper and it had a photo of me holding a microphone. The headline being, "Play It Again, Oatley, Jackie Needs a Replay." And I stopped and I read this article and it was all about how my commentary at the time hadn't gone well or hadn't been good enough or whatever. And so I'd come down from the gantry, I'd got in my car, I'd driven back the short distance to Television Centre, I'd written a script and redubbed the entire 8.5 minutes. Complete and utter nonsense. Totally untrue. What happened was I finished the commentary, I put down my microphone, got down the ladder, and I went to interview the managers. And I remember Mark Hughes saying, "How did it go?" Which I was quite surprised about because, you know, it was unusual. Okay, I think. And I thank you very much, did the interviews. And I remember distinctly walking slowly back to my car, feeling very odd about things, because normally I've done live radio and the broadcast has gone out live and that's your job done for the day. You do the interviews, you go home, it's all been aired, that's it. And instead I had this weird no man's land feeling of, I'm totally out of control. I've done the commentary. I've no idea how it's going to come out later, how it's going to be edited, what happens next. Do I phone anybody? I didn't know. So I spoke to my friend Rebecca Lowe and she said, "Oh, you know, you can phone them if you want to." And I said, "And say what?" It was all very odd. And I remember driving back to my flat and replying to a couple of text messages and then going out with some friends in Chiswick that night and having a few vodkas to ready myself. And I didn't actually watch it. I paced up and down Alison Mitchell's corridor whilst hearing the background, thinking, doesn't sound too bad. So when I read on the Monday that I'd gone back to Television Centre, redone a script, I just thought, how on earth has this become a back page story when it's simply not true? I just didn't understand how, okay, somebody maybe had been tipped off about something, or maybe it sounded a bit odd, maybe the sound levels. I'd heard lots of things about the sound levels, but that's totally out of my control. If the sound levels have been altered to try and make sure that the background noise didn't engulf my female voice, or I don't know, nothing to do with me who twiddles knobs and what have you. And then I remember, I think it was somewhere inside the paper, the very last line, the BBC deny this and say that she went home as usual and we edited the original commentary. So that was one thing. And there was no apology. I had an agent at the time and yeah, nothing happened there. And that was the only thing I have sort of issues with, if you like, was a story that was actually quite defamatory. And there was no apology, no comeback, no nothing.
Yeah, that is disappointing. I suppose that's welcome to that world to an extent, isn't it? I want to talk about the aftermath of all of this. I mentioned to you before this interview, I was going to embarrass you. I've spoken to many women over the years in football and younger than us, who see you as such an inspiration and got into it because of you. And I think that day meant the world to them and has meant the world to women since, everything that you've done. So it was worth it, wasn't it, for that reason? And it must be inspiring and a bit strange to be that kind of role model for people, because you are, no question.
I think the strangest thing about you saying that is that because I felt so under fire for so many years, actually, if I'm being completely honest, are we on the therapy couch now? I did feel really under pressure, and confidence was a big issue right the way through, from radio commentary as well. Sometimes I even felt slightly paralysed by it. I remember one game I did, it was horrendous. It was awful. That particular day, I'd been on a late shift on radio the night before, and I just wasn't feeling great. Just wasn't feeling at the race. No excuse. I should have still just done the commentary well. I just really felt under pressure, and I just felt not myself that day, and I just had an awful commentary and I was kicking myself all the way home, which obviously I learned from. But I think because I felt that people were criticising me, probably behind my back, because I didn't necessarily see it. People don't always tell you to your face, "We think you're a bit rubbish or shouldn't be doing this," or whatever. So I really battled with that for a lot of years, and especially around that time of the Match of the Day, even though I had a lot of support, which was really lovely, particularly from colleagues and some of the public, but it wasn't direct. It wasn't the way modern social media is now. So I think because I really struggled with confidence, and because I think I really struggled to feel that I belonged, hearing that and hearing anybody saying anything about, I like your work, or as somebody did randomly last night in a taxi office, and I struggle with that, because I think I was somebody who really didn't have any confidence and really, really fought the whole time to let my knowledge and ability sort of come out and not be paralysed by this big barrier, which was confidence at the time. That I think now, all these years on, and I do feel like a different person. I feel like a different broadcaster. I feel natural now. I feel at home. I feel like I belong, and I'm just happy doing the job. I'm happy to be judged on that basis. I think if it has had a positive effect, all those negative thoughts, those negative vibes over the years and the scrutiny and what have you, if that's had some sort of positive effect on other women, then hallelujah. It means it wasn't all in vain. And that's really, really brilliant now. And I love hearing Robin Cowan, Vicky Sparks, seeing other reporters. I'm not saying it's because of me by any stretch, but just seeing all these other women coming through and reporting and just being great, just doing the job naturally well, sounding confident, just doing a great job. That makes me so happy, I can't even tell you. And I think had there been no other commentators at all, had we been really in the same scenario as we were 10 years ago, where there were a couple of radio reporters, but not really any others, then I would have felt like I'd have failed to a certain extent. And I'm just glad that women now hopefully feel a little bit more as though they belong. That's the most important thing, because we do belong. There's no reason why women shouldn't talk about football, know as much about football, be as obsessed about football as any bloke. There's no reason, is there? I can't understand. When you think about it logically, there's no reason. It's just preconceptions. It's just the way people were brought up, with mums and sisters not being into football. Therefore, you have that ingrained notion that women don't get it. But hopefully that's changing.
And just finally, did anyone ever apologise?
No, I did interview Dave Bassett a few years later, and I was dying to say, "Hi, I'm Jackie Oley. Do you remember the one you said shouldn't be doing this?" But I thought, I just couldn't stop smiling. I just said, "Hi, Dave, I'm Jackie Oley," and I just started giggling to myself. I didn't say anything. I don't know if he remembers, probably not. And I just did the interview, and that was fine. Inside, I was laughing. I don't know why. I just found the whole thing mildly amusing. No, nobody has. But for me, the biggest thing is that now I feel that I belong, and that I can interview managers and have absolutely the confidence to be able to ask the difficult questions. And if they come back and have a go at me back or whatever, I frankly don't care. I'm doing my job, and there's no issues with that. But nobody's ever said, "I think we judged you harshly." I think just the fact that I feel accepted now is enough. Whether I am or not by certain people, who knows, who cares really? As long as I can do my job and I'm happy doing it and nobody physically stops me doing it, then that's great. And way more opportunities has come as a result. So no, I don't need any apologies. Don't need any apologies from newspapers or from bosses or anybody else. That's the way it was. That was life. It happened. It was interesting. We had some fun along the way. We got some stories to tell. Got a story to tell my children and hopefully my grandchildren if they're good enough to give me any. I can't wait to sit down with my daughter though, Phoebe, and talk her through it when she's a bit older. She's 6 now and is obsessed with football, and bless her, we love watching it together, and I just squeeze her tight, and it's just so much fun. I kind of can't wait to tell her a little bit about it, because to her it's normal seeing me on the TV and asking questions and talking about football. It's completely normal that girls do this. But yeah, I'm very much looking forward to that conversation when she's a bit older.
Jackie made it pretty clear in our interview that she's not overly comfortable talking about that time, and rarely does, so I'm eternally grateful to her for telling her story. Her career has deservedly soared since, although largely not as a commentator, but never underestimate what she went through that day and how it affected a whole generation of women who just wanted to be journalists. It was seismic, and even though she shrugs it off, she was a real groundbreaker. Next week on The Match, the story of a mistake that changed the course of a club's history in an episode that's simply called "It Was Over the Line, It Was Over the Line."
I didn't go to speak to him, I didn't go and ask, it was over, wasn't it? And as I say, I didn't know anything until I saw it a bit later on the telly, which wasn't even at the ground, it was later at home or that night, can't remember exactly what, although I heard a few people saying it was over the line. But you've got to get on with it. It was a mistake, I think, clearly, that's accepted. But, you know, that's the way it went.
The Match is a Speechless Media production in association with IMG Media. And thanks to all of those involved in it for their support and considerable skill. They are Matt Vines, Steve Tebb and Ollie Neen and all of the IMG team. And thanks too to Jackie for her time and patience. You can follow us on Twitter at The Match Podcast, and we'd appreciate it very much if you could rate and review us on iTunes. That helps keep us going, helps us grow, and it won't take long. And thanks for all of your kind comments so far. It means a lot to know that you like what we've been doing.
This time last year, I dreamed that you'd gone. So strange to feel obliged to stop and mourn. I dreamed you'd gone. Woke and saw you and cradled your head, thought of a million things and one that I could say to you instead. We passed the time, dear, and I cradled your head. I like to keep things simple, I hate to get too solemn. If I say that people care for what we got in common, would it be too ungrateful to say it's just not enough for us to remain? Last night.